In this episode, we're going to talk to Jason Maldonado from RelentlessSafety.com. He is also one of the three talented safety professionals from the Safety Justice League podcast. I know you've probably heard about that one. And we're going to talk about a topic that I started out thinking about when I did my 2020 recap episode. I challenged myself to improve my writing skills and ability, not just personally, but also professionally. And that's something we could all learn a little more about. That is what we're going to talk to Jason about. He has some unique perspectives around writing and developing your writing skills. And he'll get into, you know, his journey and how he became a writer. And we're going to talk about a few other things in this episode with Jason. So let's get into it. All right, everybody, before we get into today's topic, I want to remind everybody, if your business is reopening after any kind of closure due to COVID, or you've continued to remain open, but you're struggling with how to mark your facilities to ensure physical distancing and relay important information about safety and health as it relates to COVID, I want you to go visit our friends over at Mighty Line Floor Tape. Mighty Line has some great products for you to mark your floors, whether it be the stand here, the 6 feet distancing, or just floor tape to denote lanes of travel. They have everything you need to mark your facility. So hit the link in the show notes, visit our friends at Mighty Line Floor Tape. They are incredible partners in safety. I can't thank them enough for their support of the podcast. Again, Mighty Line Tape for all of your floor marking needs. All right, we're here with Jason Maldonado. I'm always afraid I'm going to mess up folks' names, so it's Maldonado. Is that correct?
Yep, you got it.
All right. So, Jason, hey, we talked recently, and we had a really good conversation, and I thought, well, you know, we should record this. This is a great topic for safety professionals, but first, let's lay some, you know, groundwork for our listeners here.
Yeah.
You're a safety professional. What got you started in the safety profession?
Oh man, it's kind of one of those stories like just about everybody has in safety, except those few that, and there's much more now, but those that went to college for it. I know there's a lot of you out there that didn't grow up saying, I want to be a safety professional, but I was in the Air Force, and I think this is a cool part of my sort of origin story. I got selected to work on a reliability system, and it tracked munitions, missile assets. And what we did, the program was built in DOS. And when I came along, they were transitioning it into Windows. And the idea behind this whole program was to predict failure. And they did it with just an incredible degree of accuracy. And the way they did it was that they took all of the maintenance data from every munitions asset in the Air Force arsenal and compiled it into this database, and then had some kind of algorithm that was super secret that spit out a prediction of when, say, a fin was going to fail or a seeker head or something like that. And I came into this project to transfer it from DOS to Windows, but I also learned the ins and outs of that mindset, that mode of thinking. And I spent about 18 months in this program. And when it was done, I developed these new skills that nobody else had. And my boss didn't want to put them to waste. So he said, you know what, I'm going to give you all the safety programs in our shop. And that was sort of the beginning. And I knew nothing. I didn't even know safety was a thing. But, you know, he threw the lockout tagout manual at me and the HAZCOM manual and even some hazardous materials management stuff and said, there's the bookshelf. Start reading. Figure it out. And from there, I transitioned into the safety office at the munition section on the base I was stationed at. And that just sort of led me into my career after I got out. Went to work for a really large construction firm. And, you know, for the past 17 years, I've worked in manufacturing, I've worked in chemical operations, I've worked in heavy civil construction, I've worked in power generation, transmission and distribution. And it's just been a wild ride. But, you know, I've always sort of kept that those roots, you know, kept that idea of trying to figure out what's going to go wrong before it does. And I think that's been a foundation for me.
Thank you for your service. I grew up in the military, Air Force as well. Grew up here at Wright-Patt.
Awesome.
And yeah, and even my brief time with the DOD and the Air Force Research Labs, you know, I ran into a lot of folks that were like that. They were like, well, we know safety's a thing, but
yeah,
it's just, it felt natural to them. It, you know, there are certain organizations that just have safety as a culture. And that's actually a pretty good sign if you think about it.
It is.
That we don't think of it as a separate thing. It's a natural thing that we have to do, right?
Right. It's got to be built in. And I think the disservice that a lot of safety professionals do, you know, I know this isn't what we were talking about today, but, you know, in the industry, we tend to go down this path where we're all about compliance and we're all about safety first and we're all about these mantras and taglines and you know, feel good stuff that looks good on paper but doesn't really move the dial in any meaningful direction. And the one of the core values, and I write about this a lot, that the Air Force brought me was very right off the bat, like you're saying, you know, it was just inherent in the culture. But when we were training, and this is something that I discussed in my book that came out a couple of years ago. In our very early training days, when we were learning how to handle munitions, there was a guy that would stand up in front of the rest of the group, and he was the reader, or girl, and they would read through the instructions, and they were so stupid simple. It was like, step one, turn the screw, 1/4 turn clockwise, and, you know, step two, do this or that, and then step three was, warning, do not do this or you'll blow up, and that's bad. And it was... We like you said, we took it for granted because it was so built into the process that safety wasn't number one. It was number three and number 16 and number 70. It was just part of the process. And I think that is where industry needs to go.
Yeah. You know, I think it was my last episode. I was just talking about that, how I mentioned I was kind of ripping on JSAs. I'm like, yeah, you know, machine operator typically has a work instruction. Mm-hmm. And it's usually on a computer, or even if it's in a, you know, like a technical instruction or TI or whatever you want to call them. Showing my age there with that one. But, you know, they have that. But then safety came along sometime after and decided, hey, you know, we're going to help with, you know, safety, you know, steps. And we had to create a whole separate document that looks, feels different. It's even, you know, separate and just hanging there. And it's usually we call it a JSA. When we could just bake safety into the work instructions in one easy to read document. We simplify the whole process. So yeah, I love that. That's a great story. Now you mentioned a couple of times, you mentioned that in your writing, and then you mentioned a book. So you're an author. I mean, technically, right? By definition, you've published a book. You're an author.
Yep. Published author and not a self-published author. Actually, I was very, very fortunate and blessed to get a publishing deal from CRC Press, which is anybody that's been in the safety realm has most likely seen at least one of those books. You got all the big names, you know, the Scott Gellers and Sidney Deckers and Todd Conklins and all those guys write safety books for CRC Press. So very humbling experience, but also very cool. But the sort of the genesis of that book was kind of a funny story, and I've told it a few times on various podcasts, mine included. But I was sitting on my dad's porch, and we were just reminiscing. And in the very beginning of my career, when I got out of the Air Force, I had just an amazing mentor. His name was Nick, and he was an older gentleman. I was 69 years old when I met him, and he passed away when he was 74. So he was kind of in declining health the whole time I knew him. But he he lived a little longer than that, but it was about 10 years that I knew him. I was kind of reminiscing about these stories with my dad there on the porch and having a couple beers, and I got a little emotional, and, you know, man, I really miss Nick. And my dad looks at me and he goes, you know, these are good stories. Like, you need to write them down. And I said, yeah, you know, I'll get to it. I'll plan on it. And he goes, no, that's not good enough. He said, you wanted to be a writer since you were like 7 years old, and you conned me and your mom into putting you through correspondence writing courses when you're in junior high, and we spent all this money on you. You went to college, you learned how to write. You're not getting any younger. You got to do it. And I was like, yeah, you're right. And he goes, no, you got to do it. And he goes, in fact, I'm going to come visit you in 2 weeks. I would think you should have about 2 chapters done by then. So I'll check them out. And
yeah, when your dad tells you you're not getting any younger, you should probably listen.
Yeah, right. I didn't realize that I was finally in the older category of you know, I kept riding on that. I'm just a young, inexperienced guy. I sat down and I started writing from this point of things that I was frustrated with. I was in a really toxic work environment at the time. The safety program was 100% compliance, 100% based on OSHA recordables, and that's all they cared about was numbers and money, and people were just a thing. You toss them out when they are no longer useful to you. And so I was writing about all these things that I was upset about in this current state that I was working in, and just, you know, ranting and raving. And about 5 chapters into it, I started looking at this and I was like, you know, this is fun and it's cathartic, but it's not really helpful. So if I'm going to write something that I one day hope to publish, I need to offer something to the profession that nobody has offered before. And I started thinking about the things that we do poorly, and they're basics, right? You think about people that get their bachelor's or master's in occupational safety and health, they learn vast, vast amounts of technical knowledge. They learn how to interpret regulations. They learn how to write up the JSAs. They learn how to write the programs. They learn how to do an audit and inspection, all these things. But we don't necessarily learn, and either path you go, whether you go to college or whether you work up your way through being a field level technician, we don't typically learn people skills. We don't learn those soft skills. I hate calling them that, but we don't learn those things that we need in order to interact successfully with people. And if our goal is truly to keep them and make them safer, we don't learn how to connect on a human level. So I started thinking about, like, what is it that we don't do? Well, things like being useful when we're out in the field and being able to connect with somebody who doesn't see through your lens, that doesn't base their thoughts on risk-based analysis. That's our job. That's not necessarily the worker's job. They're there to complete a task. And so I started listening out all these things, and then I thought about stories that corresponded with those topics, you know, writing better, designing a program, coming up with meaningful guidelines, coming up with meaningful standards. How do you set a meaningful goal? You know, what should you actually be trying to accomplish? How do you move that dial, like I said? And that's what I started doing. So I built throughout the second part of the book, I built what's called the Stupid Simple Toolkit. And it's all those things that I thought, at least in my opinion, that we don't do well as a profession, and the lessons that I've learned in order to get better at them.
Nice. And yeah, I think, you know, when we were talking, we were both kind of sharing some stories about that. It's a two-sided coin, but we often only pay attention to the one side, right?
Right.
You definitely need the technical knowledge. I mean, you could be the most creative writer and the nicest person and gets along with everybody, but if you don't know squat about regulatory, you know, standards and compliance and risk assessments, then you're going to struggle there too.
Right.
But on the flip side, the same is true. You could know all of the regs and be the biggest egghead in the room, and nobody wants to work with you, and you're going to struggle just as much.
Exactly.
So I think you're spot on, and you know that, which is why I wanted to talk to you. So why? I mean, other than that, like, why is it important? You found writing, and I do a podcast. I write. I would say I'm a light writer, and I'm still working on the book, but. I'm one of those guys. But, you know, why is it important that even if you say I'm not a very good writer, right? I'm more of a speaker. I speak extemporaneously and I'm good on my feet. But why is it important to be able to also communicate in written form, do you think, especially in our profession?
Well, so I think I'm going to argue with you a little bit about that. If somebody that says I'm just a speaker and I'm extemporaneous and I'm good on the fly, you're not. You have thought those things up. You have written your script in your head 1,000 times before it ever comes out. And writing is very much the same. I've wanted to be a writer, a fiction writer, my whole life. And I've published some fiction work. I published a little short novella last year, to varying levels of success. But I've been obsessed with learning about the really, really great writers of our time. And one of my favorite, for various reasons, one of my favorites is Stephen King. Don't love all his work, but believe it or not, my favorite book of his is called On Writing, and it's his memoir on writing. And he digs into stuff like that. He calls it, I think he, if I remember right, he calls it the people upstairs. You know, you come up with this idea and you don't really sit down and write out an outline right then. You throw it up to the people upstairs, you know, your brain, your subconscious, and you just mull over it and think about it and obsess over it for sometimes years. And then it kind of comes to fruition. One of my friends who's a very successful published author, and I won't name drop, but he told me that he used to get flack a lot. He was working for a newspaper, and people would give him flack because he'd wander around the office all day just BSing with people and, you know, not really doing a whole lot. And then he would bang out 3 or 4 articles in like an hour. And they're like, man, how do you do that? How do you write without, you know, you don't spend much time working? And he goes, I'm writing the whole time. I'm writing when we're talking. I'm writing when we're thinking. I'm writing when I'm eating. You know, all this stuff, it's in your head all the time. So I know I kind of went off on a tangent there, but
if you think about it, like, that's the same thing I do, I'm sure, like you do with your podcast. We'll get to that too. But I think about it, I'm always, people are like, well, where do you get your ideas? Where do you map out your episodes? And you know, you get a pipeline going. And I'm like, well, you know, I try to batch record as much as I can. But as far as like, I don't sit down and go, okay, I'm going to start the clock. And this is my thinking time. And during this time, I'm going to think of episodes that I can record and talk about and that I know my audience. That's not how it happens. My ideas come through conversations, like you and I had a conversation. And I'm like, dude, we got to record this.
Right.
And, you know, we're going to talk about this topic. The same thing with me. I'll have a conversation with a colleague, a podcast listener, will send me, I get texts all the time. They're asking me questions about a scenario or situation or something they're struggling with, and I'll answer them, and I'm like, yeah, man, you know what? That's a great topic. So I've got my little journal, and I don't journal like most people do. I actually, because I don't want to lose that thought, because I've done that. I'll record that tomorrow. Wake up the next morning, I'm like, what in the heck was I going to record? And so I either text myself, and yeah, so I love what you're saying, that, you know, that's a great counter to somebody who says, I'm not a good writer. I'm like, well, do you speak well? Are you able to articulate your thoughts and ideas in a meaningful way? Are you able to influence others in just conversation? Well, maybe the words will be different because, you know, you write a little different than you speak.
Sure.
But just get it. Just throw it on the paper, right? Get started.
Right. And you know, no one... you don't have to be, you know, a poetic. I write a blog on relentlesssafety.com. It's actually what I started after the book to kind of advertise it. And I've become kind of known for being humorous and quippy and then, you know, hitting right at the end with a zinger. And I've got a formula that I use for that. Not everybody's going to write that way. Not everybody's going to be able to capture that style or have, you know, maybe have a way with words. But if you can't communicate, whether it be email, whether it be a quick little Skype note or, you know, IM chat that you're going to send. Well, I dated myself there. DM chat, sorry. or even if it's a written program, because we love writing our manuals, right? If you can't write those in a way that makes sense to other humans, you're wasting your time. So, you know, and I see people do that all the time. People on at high levels in an organization, and you know, a really common mistake people make is in an email. They'll send a subject that's sort of ambiguous, and then this like 3 or 4 paragraph novel of exposition about why we're going to do this and what's transpired in the 6 months prior, and here's my reasoning on what I think is the right path forward and all this stuff. And then buried somewhere deep within those words is a to-do or an ask or a demand or whatever. and nobody gets it because they don't read that far. People don't read emails like that. You read the title and you read the first sentence. And if it doesn't capture, if it doesn't spark that interest in your mind, you will miss that requirement. And, you know, and then you end up with conflicts between, say, yourself and your boss, because they're going to be sitting there going, why didn't you do what I told you to 6 months ago in that email? And, you know, meanwhile, you've got a team of 10 people who all missed the requirement. Who was wrong in that situation, right? But you can't tell that to the boss. So that's why we need to be good at writing. We need to be succinct. We need to be able to capture language in a way that captures people's attention.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. So you said you have a formula, and I don't want you to give away your secret sauce, but it's intriguing because some people, they think, okay, there's a structure to writing and that I need to understand how to write. So what do you recommend for somebody who there's a safety pro listening and they're like, Jason's on it. I need to learn how to be a better writer. Where do they start? Where would you recommend Jason's recommendation to start down that path?
Well, this is the boring part, right? Because most people aren't going to sit there and go, well, I want to start a blog. You know, blogs are a thing of the past. Most people don't read anymore. I'm very well aware of that. But what you are going to write 100% of the time in this profession is some sort of procedure, some sort of requirement, some sort of policy at some point. What you need to understand is the message that you're trying to convey. So that's where you start. You know, what am I trying to accomplish with this? And if it doesn't include how that objective makes people safer, don't waste your time. It's just not worth it. You know, we spend so much time writing these arbitrary thou shalt rules, and they don't really do anything other than drive a metric or, you know, make some executive look good. Now, I'm not saying that you need to shirk the responsibilities that your superiors give you, but you need to be able to communicate. Again, this goes back to the very beginning, writing in your head. You need to be able to communicate, well, hey, I understand what you're requesting of me. Maybe they want you to create a policy because, we'll say somebody slipped while they were tightening a wrench or tightening a bolt with a wrench, right? So now we're going to create a policy that says thou shalt not do that because we don't ever want that to happen again. It's a pretty ridiculous ask. But so many times we fall into that trap where we're like, oh yeah, yes sir, okay, we'll go do that. Rather than saying, okay, well, I understand what you're asking for. I understand what your goal is. Why wouldn't we come up with a training program or research a better tool for the task or, you know, whatever it is. Our job should be trying to find a solution, right? So you need to figure out what the goal is and why it makes people safer. Bottom line, if it doesn't do that, again, don't waste your time. So that's where I start. And once I know what the goal is, then you can kind of fill in the blanks around it. So it's like starting at the end of the story. And that's really, you know, with my blogs, I'll come up with, you know, a topic or an example from my personal life or something like that, that I want to highlight in order to make a certain point. And then I have to fill out the direction, behind all that in order to make it make sense in a narrative. So where I start, is I try to split safety writing into three categories. And this is something that I actually have a writer's guide in my book. And the first category is standards, right? We all write standards. OSHA has standards. And the tendency for safety professionals is to take those legal requirements and just plop them onto a page with your company name on them, all the shalls and musts and wills and everything else included. Not really the best approach. And here's my reasoning for that. If all that was required to comply with any given standard, whatever it is, was to translate it into your company's letterhead, then they don't need us. What our job is to take those requirements, those legal thou shalt requirements, and make them make sense. So in your standard, it can be as simple as just, here's our operating rules. We have to do this. We cannot do that. We shouldn't do this. You know, fill in the blank after those. That's your standard. There's no direction on how to do it. There's no exposition about why it's required. You know, I'll see a lot of, another common mistake I see is people going in on a procedure or a policy and they write, we need to do fall protection because 20,000 people die every year from falling off the edge of a cliff. No one cares. And you just lost your audience. We know that falling and dying is bad. How are you going to stop it? So start with your standard. This is what we have to do. And I like to use that term a lot when I'm trying to design a program. This is what we have to do, whether it's a company policy, legal requirement, federal, state, local regulation, whatever. That's the standard. Now, you just take it a step further and you break down procedure. And in procedure, and this is what we were talking about at the very, very beginning, it needs to be written in a way that safety is built into that process, that there is no way that you can miss the safety step. At the same time, however, you're also doing the quality step and the production step and everything else so that the business as a whole functions. So in your procedures, if you ever use the word shall and you report to me, I'm your boss, I'll slap you. Not really, but I will want to. There's no reason to use the word shall in a procedure. There just isn't. And here's why. I was brought onto a project when I worked for that large construction company. And I was brought in to be a technical writer for about 18 months. And every department had a technical writer as we were standing up this plant to go into operation. And then there was a technical writing editor that was overseeing the whole program. She wasn't our supervisor, but she was the one sort of the gatekeeper. And I sat down and, you know, I'm this young, cocky, you know, really proficient writer, as far as I thought. And I sent her this procedure, and I think it was on like laser safety or something stupid, you know, something that we very rarely did. And I sent her this procedure that was just full of employees shall do this, and employees shall don their laser protective eyewear and blah, blah, blah. And she sent it back to me and said, if you ever write the word shall in a procedure again, I will trash it and you're going to have to start from scratch. And I'm like, why? That's how we write. And she goes, no, you're not a lawyer. Shall is a legal term. And not only that, it's antiquated. It's old. It doesn't make sense in today's language, but there's a deeper reason. And that is that by stating shall, you're saying what you're going to do. Put that in the context of like a New Year's resolution. You're not going to do it. You're going to say you're going to do it, but you're not going to do it. She said, write the procedure as if it's how we operate every day, day in, day out. So if you want somebody to turn the screw counterclockwise, tell them to turn the screw counterclockwise. Don't tell them employees shall turn screws counterclockwise. It's just, it goes back to the Stephen King on writing memoir. There's always words that you can take out. And that's where I would start. Because if you can take those words out, you can make it make sense almost, you know, overnight. You can change the tone of a document just by taking those types of legalese words out in a procedure, right? And then the third thing that I break down in the writer's guide is guidelines. So we have a tendency also to sit at our desks and write, and I call it legislating from your desk. We sit down and we're like, oh yeah, people need to do this and this is required. So I'm going to make them, this is the rule now. And I write down this big, bad, awful, cool procedure and nobody reads it. It just sits on the desk collecting dust. The problem with operating like that is that we don't really understand a lot of times how the work is actually being accomplished. We imagine that it's supposed to work a certain way, but it isn't really like that in real life. And so there's another breakdown past the procedure, and that's what I call the guideline. So maybe we write a procedure and it's pretty simple, straightforward. You know, you follow the advice, don't write shall, all that kind of stuff. And it's just bare bones, blank, to the point. Do this, don't do that. Do this step and all those things. But maybe there's a little bit more clarity that needs to be added, or the description just isn't something that you can necessarily write out in words. So in a guideline, you're going to go out and say, take pictures of the piece of equipment and put little arrows on them and say, okay, in step one, this is what we're talking about. In step two, this is the thing that you have to turn counterclockwise. And that's what I would put in a guideline. So standards, procedures, guidelines. That's how I design a program. And if you can write like that with that simplicity mindset geared toward your goal, then you're going to be much more successful in anything that you put out.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I remember telling somebody years ago, they were asking me, like, you know, a similar story. They wrote, pretty much copied and pasted from the OSHA standard. And I said, no, the OSHA regulations are telling employers, you know, what you have to comply with. Whatever you create has to at least satisfy this.
Yeah.
And sometimes they give you, you know, some specifics, like, you know, heights of guardrails and things like that. But, you know, you don't copy that and put it in your manual.
Sure.
You just make your guardrails all uniform. And so the difference between, and we got into this policy versus procedure, like, well, what's, we have policies and procedures. And I'm like, do you? And he was like, well, what's the difference? And I said, well, a policy is you have to, like, you would write a policy for your company that says every location must implement a hazardous energy control program. That is a policy.
Exactly.
The procedure is spelling out in your operating procedures how you're meeting that. You need to demonstrate how you're meeting the policy of having implemented a hazardous energy control program. So when I read your work instructions and it talks about how you shut down the equipment and you know, you've got training documents to prove they've been trained, but the procedure writes out like what you said. It's all baked into the whole process. Safety's in there. The actual production steps are in there. That's a procedure. It should be written like you just said. It should be written in terms that a worker performs every day. It doesn't need to read like a regulatory text. That's for somebody else. That's a whole different audience.
Exactly. Right? It is. It is. And I think that's a disservice that we do in the safety profession, is thinking that or assuming that, and I don't even think we do this consciously. It's not like a malicious thing that we do, but I think that we get so wrapped up in what we do, and everybody does this in whatever trade you're in, but we get so wrapped up in what we do that we don't understand that everybody else is looking at it from a completely different lens. And you know, I give the example a lot of times, like if we're standing side by side and we smash our heads together, we're totally not social distancing anymore, right? And we're, our foreheads are touching, and we're looking at the same blue ball, you're going to see something different than I am. That's just a fact. And we don't take those things into account when we dictate policy to people. And I think that's what I talk about when I'm talking legislating from your desk. That is such a pitfall. And it's part of the reason why people hate safety people, is that we sit there and we write these policies without understanding the impact that it's going to have to the rest of the organization. And back to my point about safety not being first, if safety was first, we wouldn't make money and we wouldn't have jobs. So there wouldn't be anybody to keep safe. So I think we need to get off of that kind of rhetoric and start talking in terms that make sense in the real world. We're not dismissing risk, and we're not saying that we're okay with people getting hurt.
Yeah.
We're being practical and addressing the fact that we have to live in this kind of imperfect world.
Right. It's not sequential. It isn't in step one, make sure you're safe.
Yeah.
Step two, go ahead and start your job. It's, and I think it was a railroad tycoon. Oh man, his name escapes me, and I'm going to kick myself because I'll think of it as soon as we end this talk. But I think he uttered the phrase, safety first is safety always. Mm. And that's exactly what it is. Safety is always a part of what we do. It should be as natural as doing our job, right? It shouldn't feel, if safety's uncomfortable, feels uncomfortable, then we're probably doing it wrong. And what I loved, some of the best technicians and tradesfolk that I came across, they were just safe naturally.
Yes.
They always had the safety glasses. That was always part of their toolkit. It wasn't a separate thing they had to do. The hard hat was always with them. You always saw them with the right gloves, and they're looking at their tools, and they're like going to replace tools. I mean, somebody in the skilled trades, you could tell they're really good because they take care of their tools, because they know the tool is only as good as the user and vice versa.
Yeah.
You don't want to have somebody who's really good at what they do and just have the crappiest tools out there. That they're part and parcel to each other. They're one and the same. a great craftsperson has great tools and they're in great condition. And because it's quality, they take pride in their work. But see what I mean? Safety is just naturally, you don't even have to say it because it's just naturally a part of it. If you're doing the other things, you're going to be safe.
If it wasn't, you would be dead. That's just
right. Yeah.
You are inherently safe at some level. You know, you can always get better. And I think that should be our focus, right?
Yeah, that should be the focus. And my son does this too. And I've even got him saying it from time to time when he shows me a video of somebody doing something stupid on social media or we see something when we're out and about, he'll go safety third. And I'm like, yep, it was third. I mean, it's to illustrate the point that, I mean, if it's first, then that means we can move it.
Right.
Right. We can move it around or we could displace it. And it's not. It should safety always. It should always be a presence.
It's a part of life. I have to throw in there, you know, that along that idea, one of my favorite and he's not a safety speaker, but one of my favorite keynote speakers, a guy named Dan Thurman. He's an ex circus performer, I think, or, you know, acrobat type guy. And he does, I mean, he's just really, really talented. Like he juggles chainsaws and flaming stuff in his keynote. It's pretty crazy. But one of the talks that he does is called Safe Danger. And he's a fairly short guy, but he's really muscular. And he gets up and there's always like a podium sitting at the front where he's talking. And he walks up without saying anything and gets up and puts his hands on the podium and flips upside down. And he's doing a handstand on top of this podium. So he's like, you know, 8 feet in the air or whatever his feet are anyway. And he starts talking to the audience while he's upside down. And you're like, what is this dude doing? And then he flips over. He kind of does like this little flippy thing and he jumps off the podium and he goes, wow, that was dangerous for you. And his point is like that, you know, everything again through different lenses, but he has a skill that you don't have. If I tried to do that, it would be a disaster and probably pretty funny. You could put me in one of those videos, but you know, he does it so masterfully because he's learned and he's trained and he's practiced and safety is built in. He knows. And I guarantee like if he knew that his shoulder was bad, he probably wouldn't do that trick that day. Right. You know, and those are the things that athletes know, that performers know, that, you know, somehow when we get into industrial settings, we're supposedly like in this padded or supposed to be in this like padded environment where no harm can come. And that's not the point. The point is that we have risks that we have to deal with and we need to figure out how to do it safely, how to address that danger safely.
Yeah. You know, there's some old school stuff that it just works. Right. And I know I'm going to date myself, but I know all the kids nowadays, right. With all the newfangled, it's, you know, it's safety 4.7 now. And it's like, no, it's pretty much all don't die at work. It's pretty much all the same.
Yeah.
But what folks, and I'm not railing against all that, but I'm just saying it's all based on the same fundamental principle. Yeah. But
exactly.
It's like that acronym, ALARP, ALARA, or whatever you want to call it, you know, as low as, you know, reasonably practicable, you know, and there is no such thing as risk-free. The question is, do we have sufficient defenses against the risks that we anticipate?
Mm-hmm.
And when we do come across something, do we have a process in place to learn from that, pivot, and continue moving forward, you know? And
right.
And that's where our energy and effort should be. And that's where communicating effectively and being, a good team player and, you know, writing effectively and being able to win hearts and minds and get along with others. That's where all this stuff comes to a head. It isn't, I mean, because you're right. Nobody would need us. All they would do is just stamp their logo on the front of the CFR and say, there's our manual.
Exactly.
And they wouldn't need us. So look, this has been, this is a great conversation. You've actually motivated me a little bit more to commit to writing. I've been threatening to finish my book for almost a year now, but, you know, I do have excuses that I use. I'm busy, you know, the podcast and all that, but I'm going to commit. I'm going to make you proud, Jason, but You know, where can folks go to read more about what you write, learn more about you, and even listen to you? You've got several things going on.
Yeah, several things. So if you want to read my writing, if you want to read my style and actually get, and this is, I want to point this out to you because I'm actually looking at it on my website, which is relentlesssafety.com. It's got the little snake logo, and it's just a challenge for anybody that's listening. If you can figure out why the snake is the logo, and let me know, then that would make me super happy. But there is a reason anyway. It's in the book and the website. But I, when you sign up for the newsletter on relentlesssafety.com, which is very, very periodic, maybe once every couple months, you get a 5-day writing for safety professionals course. It's a very, very unorthodox. That's what I was going for. Unorthodox way of looking at writing. And this is one thing everybody can get better at all times. So there's, like I said, there's 5 lessons. You get 1 email every day. And I'm looking at the first one and it says, I'm going to send you 6 of my favorite communication lessons. I'm like, wait a minute, there's only 5 there. So I got to do some editing. So relentlesssafety.com, you can read just about all of the thoughts I've ever had on safety, including some of the themes and tips and tricks, not the same material, but some of the same themes from the book. You can read that on Relentless Safety, totally free. I like to think it's pretty fun stuff. I like to keep it, I like to entertain, and I like to make it fun and funny, sometimes heartfelt. But then I try to, you know, stick you with a really impactful ending. And that's my goal with those blog posts. Not very many of them are technical, but some, yeah.
Yeah, they're informative. And I was just going to say, one of my favorites is still when you, and I'll let folks go find it and read about it. I don't want to take that experience away from them, but it was about the echo chamber, right? As safety professionals, we sort of kind of get into our own little bubble and kind of feed off each other. But I took a lot from that because, you know, with my podcast, you know, I've been doing this since 2014, and, you know, it's not that I'm antisocial, but, you know, I know exactly why I'm doing this. I know exactly who my audience is. I know exactly what, you know, because they tell me, and this is, you know, how I built purpose around doing this. And
sure,
I just never fell into that, what you were saying, where we kind of all run in the same circles. First of all, if you're podcasting and you're in safety, you all know each other anyway. We all know who we are. We all know each other.
There's only even like 5 of us.
I know, but even if somebody was like, "Yeah, I don't pay attention." Yeah, you do.
Yeah.
My whole thing has been, I think that's great. I think we should probably have twice the number of safety podcasts out there. The question is, are they of providing value? And that's where you're going to, you know, live or die as an artist or an entertainer or a podcaster is. You know, if you're not providing value and you're not doing it in a unique way, I listen to 4 different safety podcasts that I subscribe to. So, I mean, even though I have my own, I listen to others, but my style's completely different and I'm okay with that. That's me. Mm-hmm. You have a podcast, right?
I do.
So tell me about that style and what you do.
So I am part of a podcast team. It's called the Safety Justice League. Don't crucify us. We don't think we're superheroes. The idea actually came from a listener before we had listeners, but we were a group of us. It was myself, Jason Lucas, and Abby Ferry, and there was a couple others that are no longer part of the group at the very beginning. And we were filming these little video clips of, you know, just experiences and things that people had asked us over our careers, and we called them Ask a Safety Pro. And we got this comment from one of our listeners who is also a safety podcaster. He has the Probability Matters podcast, which is Kyle Krieger. I think I said that right.
That's a great podcast.
Yes, it is. And he wrote to us just as a joke. He's like, man, you guys come out with great content on your own. And we did all have our own sort of, you know, style. I did the writing. Abby does a lot of speaking. Jason was doing videos. And, you know, so we all had sort of our own outlets. And he goes, man, you guys are great on your own, but together you're like the Justice League of Safety. And I was like, haha, that's funny. And then it just kind of stuck. And so what we've really geared it toward, and what's been just amazingly rewarding, is that we're looking for superheroes. We don't consider ourselves anything super special, but we have a platform and we want to use it to uplift those good ideas, those things that safety professionals should be discussing amongst themselves and should be elevating. And we have just gotten some incredible feedback. I've learned so much about life in general. I mean, we've talked to everybody from, you know, human rights activists to race car drivers to, you know, we've got one coming up with a stuntman, motivational speakers, all kinds of places, you know, stuff that isn't, it's outside of safety, but it applies to life, and it can better a safety professional's outlook. And that's really, you know, we've been doing it just over a year now, and it's just been amazing, the reception that we've gotten, and it's grown into a sort of this little online community. You know, we do monthly get-togethers. We call them this SJL Lounge, where people just come and we hang out on Zoom and talk safety stuff. And sometimes it's not safety stuff. Sometimes we talk about candy corn and how awful it is and why Abby's wrong for liking it. And, you know, all this stuff that we do, but...
Hey, I like candy corn.
No, that's not natural. The podcast has been really cool, but it's called the Safety Justice League podcast. You can find us on any of the channels that you like, you know, Apple, iHeart, Google, Spotify, Amazon Music, all that stuff. But it's just been really, it's been a really cool experience. And I think, you know, we were talking about this when we were preparing, you know, your style is more solo and providing information for those up and coming safety professionals. And ours has sort of started out that way, where we were talking amongst ourselves and just the three of us, and it's grown into kind of an interview show, which is fun. And I think we were both kind of at this interesting place because you reached out to me and said, you know, hey, I'd like to record an interview. And then at the same time, I'm like, hey, we want to kind of back off the interviews and do more of our own thing. So, it's an interesting sort of journey that we're all on this thing.
Yeah, you're right. And you know, my listeners know this. I don't do that many interviews. I'll do a couple, but I have to, one, it's, if it's something that I would be interested in, that's my first sign right there, because, sure, you know, I know my listeners well. It's sort of based on my persona and how curious, yeah, I am about things and how I like to learn and talk about things. So, you know, I've based my listener avatar, if you will, sort of, you know, on my persona. But the whole writing piece intrigued me about, like, you know, I want to talk to somebody who's a safety professional and who writes frequently, and how, you know, how cathartic that could be, first of all, personally, because you said it started from, you know, something that was, you know, was a deep emotion for you, the loss of somebody and how you missed them, and reminiscing about all those stories. And so it was probably therapeutic, but, mm-hmm, and continues to be, but we as safety professionals, it kind of led right down into that, you know, this is one of the skills that if you're not good at this, you need help, or you need to rely or partner with somebody that can kind of filter some of this stuff for you, because you're right. We don't want to be sending out communications through an organization that just fall flat,
right,
work against us, have the opposite effect. I mean, that's just not going to end well for, you know, anybody involved. So I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about some of that stuff. And yeah, Safety Justice League, anything else you want to add before we wrap it up? I mean, I've got a list here of things I need to work on myself. So with my writing,
I could nerd out about it forever, but one thing I feel like it's really valuable. If you want more information, sign up for that newsletter and you'll get those 5 emails. I think they're valuable. A lot of people have given me good feedback on them, but just go to the website, relentlesssafety.com, and check it out. That's been pretty rewarding for me too. So if I can pass on some of those things that I've, you know, cause I'm not perfect. I have made those mistakes. I have gone down that road of thinking that I could just sit at my desk and write the coolest, best thing ever, and we're going to be the safest company because of my words. That's not the case, but you can make a difference if you do it right. So I think it's really important. It's one of those, like you said, it's one of those skills that we need, and often we don't have. So, man, this has been a blast. I appreciate you bringing me on.
I love the humility too. Yeah, we need more humility, you know, amongst ourselves. You know, we are all in this together. I love to repeat that phrase, but you know, we could all learn from each other. We're not competing against each other. We're all in the same profession. We should, you know, we're colleagues, you know, we should sort of endear ourselves to each other. And I love that you're willing to help other safety professionals out and lift them up and highlight them and share their stories on your platforms like the podcast as well. So, hey, thanks so much for taking the time. I'll have links, by the way, to your blog and to the Safety Justice League podcast as well in my show notes so everybody can take a look there.
Awesome. Thanks, man. I appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun.
All right, there you go. Jason Maldonado, thank you so much for taking time to be on the podcast. Be sure to hit the links in the show notes to get to Jason's website as well as learn more about the Safety Justice League podcast. I want to hear what you have to say. What are your writing tips? What trials, tribulations have you gone through? Do you think you're a decent writer, or is there room for improvement? As we all can improve, I'm sure. But I want to hear what you have to say about this episode. Head on over to the Safety Pro Podcast community page and join in on the conversation. If you're not a member, think about joining, and I will talk to you on the next Safety Pro Podcast.